You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the NL West. I am Allison Sutter from MLB.com, and as is usually the case, but even more so, I think that the NL West division is probably one of the more interesting ones heading into spring training, just with everything that the Dodgers have done to change their team and everything that the Padres have done to improve their team, and other clubs that seem to be on the mend. And you could probably make a case for just about any one of these teams to be a contender, come July, August, and I think it'll probably sift out to the normal cast of characters. But certainly all five teams have done a lot to improve themselves, and it should be a pretty interesting season. I am joined by my colleague Lyle Spencer, who is pinch hitting for Ken Burnick this week, and we're going to talk a little Dodgers baseball. So, Lyle, thanks for joining us. This has been a crazy offseason for a lot of teams, but especially teams in the NL West, and the Dodgers kind of were looking to improve their roster immediately without having to keep buying all these expensive free agents. So they brought in a general manager who can focus on player development, but they also are the Dodgers, so they have to, you know, maintain something at the top of the division and try to get deep into October. So there's a lot going on, and the outfield mix has sort of been resolved a little bit now that Matt Kemp has been traded. But where do you see Andre Ethier fitting in with this whole thing? Is he definitely a part of the plan, do you think, or do you think that still has to work itself out?
Yeah, I think it still has to work itself out. He is part of the plan because he's still, you know, he's a very good player in his prime. It's not like he's 38 years old. I mean, he can still play the game at a pretty high level. And frankly, I'm a little surprised somebody out there hasn't, you know, come and gotten him, because he is available. They do still have a crowd out there, and he can be a really productive player. So my anticipation is somewhere along the way, perhaps this spring, somebody's going to have a need, and they're going to see him this spring and think, hey, this guy can really help us. I would anticipate him being elsewhere. I think it would be good for him. I think it would be good for the club because, you know, if you look at it realistically, they want Jock Peterson. They're hoping that he can be sort of a left-handed version of Mike Trout, although that's an impossible bar to present for anybody. But mm-hmm. that kind of player in center field, and they want him out there. I think that's evident. And they have Crawford. Yeah. And so anyway, I do think Ethier will end up somewhere else this season.
Well, you bring up Peterson. That was going to be, you know, that's another kind of interesting and curious situation. They do want him out there, and they probably plan to have him out there. But, yeah, like Ken Gernick pointed out, I mean, he got to these numbers at AAA, you know, these 30-30 at AAA, basically because, you know, anyone else that had been on that path would have been promoted to the majors. And it was just such a log jam with the Dodgers right. that, you know, he was down there long enough to put up those numbers. But that being said, it's hard to really project what a young guy is going to do, on the major league level. And there's that fine line about, okay, we're going to throw him in there, yet there has to be a contingency plan, yet, like you say, Ethier could probably bring them something because there's going to be, a few teams that would want him. So how hard is it for them to really, focus on Peterson just being a regular part of this lineup?
Well, I think that they're pretty much committed to him, primarily because I think they believe, without question, he's going to be a defensive upgrade from day one. That was an unsettled position last year. And I think a big part of what their offseason plan was involved improving their up-the-middle defense. And they have done that, and he's part of that. He's a really good defensive player. So even if he, in the beginning, hits seventh or eighth, and, to reduce pressure on him to produce offensively, I think my sense is they want to find out. And if he struggles, and they acquired Chris Heisey, he's a fallback there. They can still, they have options with, Puig has played there. I just think they do have options, but they don't. I really don't think they anticipate him struggling. He's a very confident kid with all the tools.
And let's talk about the rotation a little bit, because it seems like the rotation is something that I'm always talking about being a little bit uncertain with the Dodgers, even though that sounds really silly with Kershaw and Greinke at the top. But the back of the rotation, I mean, there's some uncertainty. There's a lot of injury history with these guys. You know, when they're good, they're good. But when they're not, it's, you know, they're really not even on the field. So can they stay healthy? We're talking about McCarthy and Anderson. I mean, how do you see, like, the back end of the rotation, even though it's, those guys don't get the star billing, but it's a huge part of what makes a six-month season work. And
right.
those guys are going to have to stay on the field.
I agree with you, Allison. I think that probably, for me, is the biggest question mark coming in, how that will shake out. They must be convinced that those two guys are completely healthy and ready to deliver on their ability. I mean, but if those guys are healthy and productive, they're as good as you'll find four and five in a rotation. I've seen enough of both of them, and I think they're betting on them being able to physically hold up. And if they don't, they have a few options down below. And you know, with their resources, they're always capable of going out and making a deal for somebody. Personally, I was a little surprised they didn't try and sign a guy who would be more of a sure thing to give them 200 innings, a guy like Ervin Santana, say, who was out there and readily available. But as I said, these are smart guys. They come highly recommended, the new regime here. And so I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt on this one until further notice. If these two guys are healthy and sound, that's going to be a phenomenal rotation.
And they have said so far for now, well, they've really said that no, that they're not going to be in on Scherzer or Shields or Hamels for that matter. I mean, do you believe that? Do you think that they're sincere? They seem to be saying that they're pretty happy with the rotation that they have heading to spring training.
Yeah, I think they're content. It sounds to me like they're pretty content with their entire club. They've made some interesting bullpen additions, and I think they're going to be solid there. I know a lot of people have questions there, but I think they overlooked the fact J.P. Howell had a tremendous season last year, and that tends to get overlooked in front of Kenley Jansen, and they acquired Joel Peralta, who's proven seventh, eighth inning guy, and they have a few other guys back there who have a lot of potential. Baez, I think, has a live arm. He could be a really effective seventh inning guy. And Sergio Santos, who they signed to a minor league deal, is proven back end reliever if healthy. And if he's healthy, then they're in really good shape in the bullpen, I believe. And as for their overall roster, I think they've got depth everywhere, and I think they're in pretty good shape.
And it's interesting because, I mean, I find kind of what the Dodgers did even a little bit more fascinating than what the Padres did, even though the Padres that was by far the most compelling storyline to watch, but they just have so much work to do that they're almost, I don't want to say starting over, but they really overhauled. But the Dodgers, they traded Kemp and they said goodbye to Ramirez. But have we thought enough about like really how that affects the offense? And did they gain enough back to make up for what they were losing? I mean, it's one thing, okay, well, our outfield is too crowded, and well, Hanley is this and that. But okay, now they have to still figure out how to keep that offense humming. What do you think about that as far as just how they replace those guys?
Yeah, they lost obvious power with Ramirez and Kemp. I mean, there's no getting around that. But, Jimmy Rollins can drive the ball, and so can Kendrick. They're basically gap hitters, but they're very productive players. They're consistent. They're durable. I think they'll be fine with those two guys replacing basically Ramirez and D. Gordon, what they produced offensively. I think Puig settling in, relaxing as an everyday right fielder rather than kind of bouncing around. I think, you know, a lot of people overlook the fact that in spite of all the attitudes people have toward him and his behaviors and demeanor and those kinds of things, the guy was a pretty productive player last year and figures to get better because he's such a young guy. So, you know, and Carl Crawford, Scott Van Slyke, very effective right-hand hitter against left-hand pitching, so that can be a highly effective left field platoon. So and Juan Uribe, they didn't have him all year last year, and he's always been sort of, to me, the glue there with that team, highly underrated defensive player, clutch hitter, great clubhouse guy. And, of course, Adrian Gonzalez, I haven't even mentioned, one of the most consistent offensive players and defensive players in the game. So I think what they're looking at is it's going to be a solid offense. It won't be, you know, eye-popping, as explosive potentially as it has been, but I think it will be a productive offense that will give you enough offensive support behind a really good pitching staff.
And, of course, we're always going to talk about Don Mattingly. If they get off to a slow start, do you think the quote-unquote hot seat would apply here? You know, the ownership, everyone knows that they sort of inherited him, and but the clubhouse, he seems to be like an inside-the-clubhouse kind of guy, and maybe not the greatest tactician, as they say, but do you think that they'll be rumbling starting if the Dodgers start slowly?
Well, yeah, I think it's going to be real interesting to see how all that unfolds, because there will be a totally new clubhouse dynamic now. And so he'll have sort of a, you know, I think a clean slate with this group of players in terms of internal leadership. And you know, I think you're right in a lot of ways. A lot of people think the jury's still out on Mattingly in terms of how good a manager he is. We don't really know. And obviously, management believes in him, and that they, you know, and they're entrusting him with a lot of responsibility here, and feel he and his staff are capable of getting the job done. And so, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. And I don't think anybody knows how a whole new management team is going to respond if they do struggle again. And, you know, that's the great unknown. It's going to be a really interesting season in every respect, I think. And you know, I think I've known Mattingly since he was a player. He's a guy who loves challenges. He made himself into, for me, a Hall of Fame level player. And I'm sure he's determined to show he can be just as good a manager as he was a player. And here's the opportunity to show that.
Speaking of the Hall of Fame, I mean, you've been around quite a while, and you've seen a lot of elections. And what did you think? What do you think? Like, there seems to be obviously a ballot issue with how crowded it is. There's a lot of guys that, you know, didn't make the cut. Their vote totals are very low. But it seems like that's going to clear out a little bit now after this year. And really, the only slam dunk first ballot guy next year will be Ken Griffey Jr. So. Do you think that a lot of these other guys are going to get more support as time goes on? And what did you think about some of the guys that didn't make it, like Piazza, Bagwell, those guys?
Yeah, I do think that will happen. I think this was a loaded class. Next year's is not as loaded. I think voters will take a harder look at a number of guys. You mentioned Piazza, Bagwell, Tim Raines, Mussina, Schilling. There are a whole slew of guys. I've always been a big Fred McGriff supporter. I was an Alan Trammell supporter. I was a Mattingly supporter. I thought players from that era, their numbers got kind of dwarfed, and unfortunately, like a McGriff in his time, I thought he was for sure a Hall of Fame player. What he did, he was probably to me the most feared hitter in a lot of ways of that time, and. So, yeah, I do hope voters take a much deeper look at the credentials of some of these guys who have gotten overlooked recently, because there are a lot of really good candidates. I've always felt Raines is a slam dunk Hall of Famer. Bagwell. Piazza looks like he's got a really good shot of making it next year, and Bagwell's right there with him, I think. So I do think it opens up a lot of doors, hopefully. And I've never been one who feels, you know, we need to keep it to a select few players. I guess I'm kind of a liberal in this sense, but I covering the game for 40 years, I think I've seen a lot of Hall of Famers who haven't made the Hall of Fame.
I think I'd agree with you. A lot of people seem to agree with you, but I don't know. Some of these totals just seem really low, and I would expect, it wouldn't surprise me if some of these guys jump 20% next year, but we will find out. So, Lyle, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate pinch hitting, and we'll see you soon. I am joined by my colleague, Chris Haft, who is covering the Giants from MLB.com, coincidentally enough. So, Chris, we are here in January, and so we're about 6 weeks away from spring training, which is a lot of time, but not that much time, and things are slowly moving for the Giants, but there was a little bit of news that came out recently that Tim Hudson had to have some ankle surgery to remove some bone spurs. So, you know, sometimes this happens, and he'll be out a couple months, but even though it was downplayed by Bruce Bochy and everybody seems to be optimistic about it, you have to, I guess, consider the fact that Tim Hudson is going to be 40 this year. So does that change kind of the outlook on what the recovery process might be or how serious this might be?
Well, you know, if you take everybody's word for it, no. And you just have to accept the club's insistence that he'll be ready for the start of the season. Now, he'll probably have to that this will probably move him to the back end, to the very back end of the rotation, number five starting spot, which is the spot he might have occupied anyway. The thing is, they can easily slide in, Yusmeiro Petit into that spot if Hudson's not ready. Rookie Chris Heston might also be a possibility, depending on how he performs in spring training. But for now, it's they don't really have much margin for error, Allison, because they're still counting on, they're still hoping that Tim Lincecum can be an effective starting pitcher. But they're not, if they were to really come out and be honest about it, they're not sure, and they think Matt Cain will bounce back from his right elbow surgery to have bone spurs removed. But that's not 100% certainty either. The only 100% certainty is a pretty good one. That's Madison Bumgarner, who, you know, you don't need to say anything about what he, I think everybody knows what he's done, what he's capable of. But he threw 270 innings last year. How is he going to bounce back from that? If anybody can, you know, withstand that kind of, you know, work effort hangover, so to speak, it's him, because he's maybe one of the strongest guys in the major leagues. But and he throws so easily. But that being said, you gotta wonder. I think it's gonna be something to watch, a question mark, as spring training begins.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of looking at the depth chart, and you know, when I look at other teams, there might be 7, 8, 9 names like under the rotation. And really, you know, when I look at the Giants, there's like 6 names on there, and like you said, I mean, the three of them just stand out as maybes, like with Kane, with Hudson now, Lincecum. I mean, you just don't really know what you're going to get from him. And whereas, you know, Petit can slide in for one of them, and Bumgarner can not pitch every single day. Do you feel like there's a lack of depth? I mean, you know their system better than I do. Do you feel like there's a little bit of a lack of depth, like in the upper echelon of the minor leagues as far as starting pitching goes? Are they still grooming some guys in the lower levels? Like, what's going on inside the organization?
Yeah, not major league ready starting pitching, Allison. That's the thing. They've got some pitching prospects. There's no doubt about that. But they haven't pitched above AA. You know, they're going to have to, if the Giants feel forced to call upon those guys this year, those particular guys will have to mature pretty quickly.
And you mentioned Bumgarner's workload last year, which is just mind-boggling. I mean, I've not really studied, like, you know, guys that pitch deep into the World Series, you know, how many innings that they do compile throughout a season. 270 is just, it's like what Nolan Ryan used to do, you know, in a regular season just because he was Nolan Ryan, but nobody else came close to doing that. And, you know, Bochy may approach him about possibly just like skimming a little bit off of his workload, maybe giving him an extra day's rest when possible. But that's hard to do to your ace. I mean, I know that those like extra days of rest or you know, when a fifth starter will be skipped in the rotation when there's enough off days. And I would imagine that, you know, a guy at the top of the rotation and having the success that Bumgarner has had, that's not going to really sit well with him. Like, no, I don't want to pitch on 5 days rest. I mean, do you think that could turn into an issue?
I'll tell you why I don't think it will, because Bruce always has, for the most part, not skipped the number five starter over the past 2, 3, 4 years. I mean, he's always given the ace and the other people in the rotation that extra day of rest, whether that ace was Tim Lincecum or Matt Cain or now Madison. They almost staunchly refuse to, kick the number five starter out, or skip the number five starter, I should say, and pitch everybody else on, regular rest. And I think that speaks to why, for the most part, San Francisco's pitching has been so effective in the last few years, because, everybody gets that regular, or I should say extra rest when the time comes. And so they're in good shape. And so I don't think, and I don't think Madison's going to complain about the occasional 5 days of rest. I think he'll welcome it. But it's funny you mentioned Nolan Ryan. He's got that same kind of, Madison has that same kind of work ethic. So there again, if anybody can handle this sort of workload, it's him.
You've covered baseball for a very long time. You've covered many different managers. And I think it's interesting, something that maybe the general public, the fan base, doesn't really get to peer into is how different managers are about protecting pitchers' arms, and how some are maybe a little bit more careless, even though I don't, that might be too harsh of a word. But there are some managers that are like, I mean, I covered Jimmy Williams in Houston. I mean, he was obsessive about making sure that he's not abusing any of the starting pitching arms, and well, really any of the pitchers. And I mean, to where, every pitch, every warm-up pitch that a bullpen guy would toss, I mean, he was just paying so close of attention to that. And really, I mean, you have to hand it to the ones who understand that they're not just trying to win games, but they're trying, they care about a pitcher's longevity and how long he can stick around. Have you seen, like, a lot of the, you don't have to name names, but just, like, through, your experiences, I mean, are there very definitive differences in a lot of managers when it comes to that?
Yeah, there are some differences. I covered one manager. We'll just let him remain nameless. Who I think ruined a pretty good pitcher's arm by allowing him to throw, leaving him out there for like 130, 140 pitches. I think the first or second start of the season on a really unseasonably cold day in Cincinnati, and
wow.
that was it. That was it for this guy after. After that outing, Bruce Bochy, I can say it because maybe it's not that controversial, but or even if it was controversial, I'd go ahead and say it anyway. But it's not what I was about. What I'm going to say is about him is Bruce seems to have a knack for knowing, whether he goes to an extreme, which extreme to go to, whether a certain guy should be yanked out of there after 80, 85 pitches, even if he's doing okay. He just has a sense for, maybe giving him a quicker hook. And or if a guy is just on a roll and maybe he passes the usual 100, 110 pitch limit, which is when all managers start to kind of, freak out, he'll let the guy go to 120 or 125. If he just feels like the guy can handle it, and nobody's had, with the exception of Kane's bone spurs, that's not really a sore arm. Nobody's had a sore arm. Bruce knows pretty much and knows how key to strike, so to speak, with these guys.
that would explain why he's been a manager for World Series teams, or partially explain it, I guess. But so let's move on to some of the other, you know, maintenance things here. We have a cleanup situation. So while the Giants have found a third baseman, I don't think that you're going to see Casey McGee flipping into the middle of the order to replace Sandoval that way. So it's going to be sort of a mix and match thing, which I think is really kind of funny. Every time I talk to you, I just feel like these are questions that are asked about teams that are just trying to, you know, maybe break 500 or maybe still be in the contention conversation in July. But, you know, the Giants seem to always be in it at the end, even though they have some, like, major questions. But you sort of see maybe Pence, Posey mixing and matching in the middle of in the lineup situation, at least starting to start the season.
Yes, you know, but I think Bruce will play the hot hand. He'll go with matchups. I think Brandon Belt will be part of that mix. So, you know, assuming he hits okay. I don't think they get too caught up on who hits third, who hits fourth, who hits fourth, who hits third. I remember I wasn't covering the team back then, but back in the Barry Bonds, Jeff Kent era, you know, it was my brethren in the media always made a big deal. Oh, who's hitting third? Who's hitting fourth? You know, between Bonds and Kent. Did it really make that much of a difference when they were, you know, averaging five runs a game and each of those guys was an MVP candidate every year? I don't know if it did. Although I guess there were a couple points when, you know, I think the team took, if I remember correctly, the team maybe took off after a certain, after Dusty Baker settled on some, you know, certain alignment, you know, in between those two. But for the most part, you know, it was just, you know, well, you know, they're both good hitters. It doesn't matter where we put them and let her rip. And I think that part, that's going to be mostly Bruce Bochy's philosophy with Pence, Posey, and maybe Brandon Belt.
And let's talk a little bit just about the division. I don't think that we've talked since the Padres went all crazy on us, reshaped their entire roster. How do you see just, you know, with the Dodgers and the Padres having made, you know, huge sweeping changes? Where do you see the Giants in this whole thing, and what do you think about what some of these other teams have done?
I think it's going to be a more every year, you know, the people in the NL West say, oh, it's a balanced division. And this time I really do think it's a more balanced division because of the improvements the Padres made. I don't know if the Dodgers necessarily made themselves better, but and they still have a lot of talent. You know, Arizona's not letting the grass grow underneath its feet. And Colorado, I think they're always a factor just because of that, you know, that they play so well at home. And the other teams hate playing there. So I think it's going to be, I think it will be as much of a dogfight, if not more, than it always is every year.
Yeah, I think it's always going to be a division that people keep their eye on because, you know, with the Dodgers and the Giants especially. But, yeah, I mean, you can't really count out. I feel like it's just going to maybe nobody's going to really be able to run away from it. There might be more teams that seem to still be in the picture maybe in July and August before,
exactly,
you know.
Yeah, I agree.
Fall out. Yeah. Okay, well, Chris, thank you so much. Happy New Year, and we'll be talking to you very soon. I'm here with my very busy colleague, Corey Brock, who has done nothing but write stories about the Padres for what seems to be the last 12 or 13 years, but it's only actually been about a month since the winter meetings happened and everything exploded and the Padres all of a sudden became the team that everybody's talking about, and A.J. Preller became the most interesting man in the room. So, Corey, I don't know where to start. So I think we'll just start with, you know, just about everybody that came to the team. I mean, of course, we have Matt Kemp, who was introduced at an earlier time. And then just a couple days ago, the four, Justin Upton, Will Myers, Will Millbrooks, and Derek Norris were also introduced. So I guess my first question to you is just when you heard, when all this stuff started happening and all of these deals were being made, what was your reaction? Your initial reaction?
Well, I was astonished, I think. You know, just kind of watching this whole offseason kind of transpire was kind of like a soap opera in the sense that the not a whole lot of activity at first. And then we, of course, knew that the Padres were very, very interested in Pablo Sandoval, a free agent. And then actually offered him more money than the Red Sox did, only to see him sign with the Red Sox. And then, so I think there was a little bit of a lull there, but only to see A.J. Preller, who, important to keep in mind, has never done this job before, go in a completely different direction instead of attacking the free agent market, turning his attention to trades and kind of casting a wide net, getting a lot of lines in the water. Allison, I'm using a whole lot of tired cliches here, but, just trying to identify a lot of different targets and sort of seeing what kind of nibbles he can get. And he got a lot of nibbles. And in the end, he got a lot of interesting pieces, a lot of impactful offensive pieces. And, we talked, Allison, so much last year about how bad this offense was. This was the worst offense in baseball by a long shot. And they knew they had to make some upgrades. I don't think anyone could have ever imagined them making so many upgrades and so many impactful upgrades. We're talking Matt Kemp here. We're talking Justin Upton, Will Myers. These are former All-Stars. These are former Rookies of the Year, Silver Sluggers, guys who are entering their prime, guys that have some upside, guys who are club-controlled. I think if you're a Padre fan and you've been starved for something like this, the team hasn't made the playoffs since 2006, and you've kind of had your heart broken year after year, you have to be excited about what you've seen happen.
And I have to play the devil's advocate just for a second because, these guys, obviously there aren't any players that ever come with guarantees, but you can look at track records, you can look at the past couple of years, even just the last season, what they did. And, there are still question marks. Will Middlebrooks will be competing for a job. He's got some competition, especially with Corey Spangenberg, possibly. They want to find a place for him and try to get him in the mix. And, Will Myers, he actually had, a really bad year last year. And like he said, it was his first bad year, his only bad year. And he had a wrist issue that certainly hindered him. But there still are some question marks around here. I think that Preller is just trying to sort of throw everything in the mix, see what works, and then see what kind of springboard he has moving forward. But this isn't just an instant division favorite, I guess.
Yeah, and it's sure. Do all these guys come without warts? No. And I think you identify Will Middlebrooks as a potential change of scenery, bounce-back guy. Will Myers in the sense that, was bothered by the wrist injury last year, and A.J. Preller even admitted that, had he not had the wrist injury and had the down year because of it, that, they probably wouldn't have had a chance to obtain him. Why would the Rays have shipped him otherwise? He was Rookie of the Year in 2013. Matt Kemp had that monster second half last year. Certainly it turned out in the physical. He has the two arthritic hips. I don't want to say that he's past his prime. I still think he has some good years left in him, and he takes very good care of himself. But these guys, there is no perfect player, I guess, is what I'm trying to say here. But these are all moves that they rank on whole as still tremendous upgrades, just given the state of the team where it ended the season last year. This wasn't just a league average offense. This was well, well below. So they had to do something. They had to react. And what I found interesting, Allison, that these are all moves that are, these are all win now moves. And the Padres had to move a lot of interesting assets. They had to move, some minor league prospects, guys that they drafted and developed. They spent some money on, they invested in. And, A.J. Preller comes in not having any real attachment to any of these guys. These are no guys that were drafted on his watch. And, he had no sentimental attachment to any of them. So, eventually some of those guys could turn out to be some pretty good players. But it's interesting that, he feels that this is a team that can win now. And maybe in baseball, Alice, the window is small, not just for the Padres, but it's small really for all these teams. And, having this long view of building a winner, I know the Astros are kind of taking the slow and steady approach and building through the farm system. And I'm not saying that's the wrong way to go, but maybe it's we're sort of in a time now where you kind of need to strike quickly.
And I like that Justin Upton. I think that two of the really compelling storylines that we might want to follow. First of all, Justin Upton, who hits a lot of home runs at Petco. So he's got 291 lifetime average, but 10 home runs are the most he's hit anywhere for, I guess, a road ballpark as an opposing player. But being a free agent after the season, and then the Padres would have some decisions to make. And so I feel like he's going to have this, like, monster year. And then the Padres are going to, you know, have to figure out if they want to sign him or offer him a qualifying offer or whatever goes there. But that's got to be pretty encouraging to bring in a guy who actually hits well at that ballpark.
Well, and I think that's that really played into the acquisition that, you know, he has a pretty good sample size and he knows the division well. He's not scared off by this ballpark. And, you know, I think one thing that's sort of proven, or maybe it's a misnomer that this is, you know, we joke and we call it Petco National Park, but, you know, they've made some alterations to the fences here, you know, since the ballpark opened in 2004. And one thing that's sort of held true since the ballpark opened is it does play true for right-handed power. And A.J. Preller, if you look at his acquisitions this winter, has obtained some guys with right-handed power. Kemp, Derek Norris even has some. Justin Upton certainly has a lot. Middlebrooks. These are the guys that can drive the ball, can turn on the ball. And the thought process is if you square it up from the right-hand side, it's going to go. It's going to be a home run here from the right-hand side is a home run everywhere else. So, you know, I think that, you know, this is going to be – it's an interesting acquisition in the sense that, you know, the Padres didn't obtain him thinking, well, you know, we're going to pin all our hopes on maybe we could convince him to stay and he could sign a long-term contract. You know, they'll make a run at him. But they'll be perfectly content making that qualifying offer and, you know, collecting that draft pick after the first round. That's going to be a good draft pick. You know, let's be clear on that. That's a high draft pick. So, you know, I think they'll make him an offer. I think they'll make him a fair offer, and you know, we'll see. Maybe he'll fall in love with San Diego. You know, there's certainly worse places to end up. But you're right, Allison. This is a walk year. This is a guy in his prime. This is a guy who's had success here. I think he's poised for a monster year.
And I think the other really interesting thing to keep an eye on is just Matt Kemp. Any player, once you get to the major leagues, you get players at this level. I mean, there's a reason why they're there, and a lot of it's just their kind of mental capacity for being tough. And the flip side of that is that they also get, you know, they got kind of get a chip on their shoulder if they feel they've been slighted or if they're not wanted. And I just think, you know, I mean, they understand that this is a business, but the fact that the Dodgers traded him to a division rival, and you know, even though it totally makes sense and they're paying, you know, a lot of his salary, but it's still, he's going to look at it like the Dodgers didn't want me anymore. And just the amount of time that these two teams are going to be playing, I think it's going to be fascinating to see, you know, what he brings kind of from an emotional standpoint when he plays as many games as he's going to be playing against the Dodgers.
Yeah, and you never really know what makes these guys tick. You're right, Allison, and that maybe, yeah, kind of a chip on your shoulder that, hey, you know, I've been a Dodger my entire career. And, you know, you never really know if you're going to stay with these guys forever and, you know, pull a Tony Gwynn or a George Brett or whatever. But, you know, that, you know, the Dodgers certainly had a surplus of outfielders and, you know, they could have moved any of them, but they chose to move him, and you know that you have 18 matchups, and that's four plate appearances a game, and he's got certainly some opportunities there, and maybe the same sort of holds true for Will Myers. Certainly not in the sense where he could, you know, he'd take out his whatever angst or vindictiveness or whatever. Maybe not the right choice of words on the Rays because they don't play them, but maybe a chance to hey. Maybe I'll prove to the Rays that they gave up on me too early. So, you know, we never know. He did say that, you know, he's going to do his best to prove that A.J. Preller made the right trade. So, you know, these guys are driven. These guys are competitive. That's part of the reason, aside from, you know, natural ability and a wonderful skill set that makes them so successful. So let's not discount that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very underrated element of this game. It's just that these guys, I mean, they don't think that they're, like, when we can look at it objectively and just be like, well, this isn't a very good team, or these aren't very good players. And those players, I mean, they've always been the best players no matter where they've been their entire lives, and they really, truly do not see what we see. Like, they see themselves as the very best. among everybody. And I think that's, you know, I think you could say 750 baseball players in the major leagues probably feel that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're right. And we should never pretend to think what they're thinking. You know what I mean? Because we never walked in their shoes. We're not elite athletes, and we're not driven. You know, we're driven in different ways that they are. But these guys, yeah, you're right. They're the best of the best. That's why they're doing this. That's why they get compensated like this. And you know, I would never surmise as to think that, you know, that Matt Kemp might not. You know, I would never try to get it, climb inside his head and try and figure out what his motivation is. You know, I have no idea. All I know is that this guy has been an elite athlete, an elite baseball player for a number of years. And, you know, and as long as, you know, his body's willing, I would expect that to continue.
Yeah, I'm predicting a monster year from him. And there's one other element that I don't think we really touched on. Have we talked enough about the bullpen? It looks pretty good, and there have been a couple additions lately. And I know that the Padres feel like they have the roster pretty much set at this point, so I wouldn't expect a lot to happen between now and spring training. But the bullpen, Preller came in and sort of tweaked that too. So what can you tell us about, what do you think about how that's shaking out?
Yeah, A.J. Preller went into hiding for 9 days over the holidays, Allison. It was the most wonderful thing ever. And emerged from his cave, and now I know he was back in New York spending time with his family and his sister, and he has three nephews, I'm sure, are all wearing Padre gear today. Came back and made a couple of deals, one with the Yankees for Sean Kelly, a hard-throwing right-handed reliever, and one with the Mariners, picked up an interesting piece in Brandon Maurer. They dealt Seth Smith, who certainly became expendable with the bevy of outfielders the team obtained last month. Now, Seth Smith, certainly one of their better offensive players from last year, and they certainly weren't looking to get rid of him, but kind of became a redundancy, certainly, with the acquisitions of late. So, it's interesting. You can sort of see how he's setting up the bullpen now. Joaquin Benoit, is the incumbent there at the back end. He will close games, but he's looking for power arms, and he sort of has that now in Kelly and Maurer, who I assume Kelly will pitch the eighth inning, and Maurer will probably be the seventh inning guy, a guy that started in the past for the Mariners. He's only 24, but pitched very well in relief last year in the second half for Seattle. And, he's controllable. They'll hang on to him for a few years. Kelly's 1 year away from becoming a free agent. But, this is sort of how the Padres have done it for years, run prevention, pitching and defense, and starting pitching has been good. The relief pitching has always been among the league's best, and they feel very good about their pitching staff. And, for years, Bud Black's kind of leaned on that, for success, and they've kind of always fallen short because the offense has always been, I wouldn't say second rate, but has certainly fallen well behind. Well, this year they're a lot more balanced, and I think that's what they've kind of been looking for, a much more balanced team, and the offense is certainly a lot more on par with the pitching, more so than it's ever been in his previous eight seasons.
Yeah, well, I have a feeling that there's going to be a lot of attention put on the San Diego Padres when they report to spring training. So thank you, Corey, very much, and I'm sure we'll have much more to talk about next time. Thanks a lot. I am here with my colleague, Thomas Harding, who also wishes you a happy new year and is also from MLB.com. And so, Thomas, now that we are kind of in the stretch run of the off season, I kind of feel like it went by quickly because those winter meetings were so insane, but we are still about 6 weeks to spring training, and the roster seems to be shaping up a little bit to look like they might when the season starts, even though we can't really predict at this point. But I liked your mailbag, your inbox on the Rockies website, and I liked the way that you formatted that. And the questions were interesting, and you were very candid with one of the questions about do you honestly think that the Rockies can compete in this NL West with the current roster? And you feel that really there needs to be some work done with the pitching. So why don't you talk a little bit about that, what you think needs to be done, and how you feel about the lineup, which looks pretty healthy right now.
The lineup, which is, always dependent on health, is a very good one. It's as good as any in the West, and I think that's where a lot of people probably forget, because if you look around at the, say, San Diego Padres and all that they're doing this offseason, it's, wow, they're really building their team, and the Rockies aren't. The issue with the Rockies is they have a very good lineup, which the Padres did not. Where the Rockies have problems, though, is pitching, and they need to make the right pitching moves. They don't need to be huge. They need to make the right pitching moves to enhance that lineup. If they pitch decently and that lineup performs to its capabilities and guys don't get hurt, yes, that is a team that can contend, and I believe that's the case with everybody in the West. I mean, whether it's the Diamondbacks, the Padres, or the Rockies, they look at what happened last year with the Giants winning 87 games and then jumping up and down at the end, winning the World Series, then everybody feels that they can do the same if they make the right moves. Issue with the Rockies, though, is I'm looking at the pitching staff, and I'm still expecting when are they going to bring in the veteran type that will give them a whole lot of innings and give them solid work, you know, and can they improve that bullpen? Until those things happen, you can't expect a huge improvement from this team.
So do you feel like, I mean, some of these prices maybe need to come down a little bit? I mean, some of these free agent names, Aaron Harang, Paul Mahalan, Kendrick, Correa, I mean, do you think that Scherzer and Shields are obviously on a different plane and probably not in any kind of financial plan for the Rockies, but do you see them sort of, are they waiting it out? Or are they just, is there a market that still needs to be established?
I believe that they are waiting out the market right now, and who knows if Shields is in their price range. I know there were reports of a deal of over $100 million, but there have been reports about various people this offseason that that didn't come to fruition as far as the price is concerned. So I do think that they are monitoring that, but I doubt that they're going to jump into that. One of the reasons they're waiting so long is they're trying to see if they can make some sort of trade to get this done. It is a lot harder to get a true quality pitcher in here through free agency than it is by trade. Now, if they don't do that, then the guys like Mahalan, Kyle Kendrick, and guys like that, maybe they fit in the Rockies' price range, and if those guys are willing to come in here and pitch, and you look at Kendrick, he should be able to get ground balls. You look at a guy like Mahalan, who's pitched pretty much everywhere under any condition, he's a pretty good one. Then maybe you have some leadership for that staff. The staff itself, if they're healthy, I see some possibilities in them. Now, you can't just sit here and say that this is that these guys will match up with the Dodgers and Giants, but when you look at a guy like a Tyler Matzik and also Jordan Lyles, the way they pitched at times last year, and you add them to Jorge De La Rosa and a healthy Jolys Chacin, that's actually a pretty good young core that you could see adding a veteran that would raise the standards of the staff would help. You know, James Shields did that with the Royals. He went in and really, because he had been in the postseason and he had been through a whole lot with Tampa Bay, he was able to get those guys on board with him and say, hey, wait a minute, just because we're the Kansas City Royals, it doesn't mean we can't all pitch 200 innings and we can't all be durable. That's what the Rockies need.
And I do think that the Shields-Royals dynamic, I think that opened up a lot of eyes. I mean, a lot of people are talking about that, just like you said. I mean, because it's not like he was completely lights out. And, I mean, he was kind of just an average guy in October. But what he brought was so valuable that you can probably account for how deep into October they went just by his presence alone.
No doubt about it. And the funny thing about it is one of the guys on that staff was Jeremy Guthrie, and the Rockies tried him a few years ago thinking that he would be that guy here, but Guthrie, it turned out, could not pitch at Coors Field. He went to Kansas City and did quite well, but he couldn't pitch at Coors Field, and when your leader is saying things like, you know, what is it, five is the new three at Coors Field, that's where you run into some problems. So they do have to be sure that the guy they bring in can pitch here. And certainly all the indications were Jeremy Guthrie could, but it just didn't work out for him. So if you can bring in somebody that will just raise that standard, I mean, you have Jorge De La Rosa, and he does it, but he's a very quiet guy. Maybe you need somebody else also for the pitchers to look up to in that respect. And maybe, who knows, Jolys Chacin, if he's healthy, he makes the most of the talent that he has, and he makes a difference because the Rockies have a lot of young pitching other than those guys. I mean, you look at Lyles, you look at Metzik, also John Gray, Eddie Butler, Tyler Anderson coming up through the minors. They've got some good young guys there, so what they're going to need to do is establish some sort of standard at the big league level that, hey, we're going to give you innings, we're going to battle. If things go wrong in a game, we're still going to be out there battling. If we have to win at 8-7, then so be it. That's what they need from a pitching staff.
So let's give you the obligatory 22nd squashing of the Tulowitzki to the Mets rumor. I think we're just going to have this as a standing feature until this whole thing gets resolved. So it, the rumor just comes and then it goes and then it's and then it just goes. So what would you weigh in on that, Thomas? How would you like to address it this week?
Well, it seems at this stage it's like it seems to have always been all winter. We're talking a whole lot more about it than the Rockies and the Mets are. There is a possibility that the Rockies could make a move for Dylan G on their starting staff a little bit later this month. I've been told that if it's going to happen, it would be a little bit later. Whether Tulowitzki's name comes up in that, I have no earthly clue. I mean, we're sitting here reading the tea leaves right now, and at this stage, I'm looking at the Rockies' promotional schedule, and there is a Troy Tulowitzki bobblehead planned. So if he has a bobblehead, that means they can't trade him before the season, right? I have no idea, but hey, that's about as far as we can go on that one.
I think sometimes it's a curse, not so much the bobblehead, but I find that T-shirt night. Often guys will be traded just before, you know, their T-shirt night, which, you know, I don't know if that's like the Sports Illustrated cover curse or whatever, but.
Of course, with the Rockies, it needs to be correctly spelled T-shirt night, but we won't go too far into that one.
Okay. Well, let's move on to behind the plate. So there's Nick Hundley. Seems to be getting some good reviews as far as what he can bring to the team, and a point being made, I believe, from you is that having played in the NL West, he knows the hitters, he knows the division, and that should be a good thing. So what happens with the backup catcher, and what's going on with that?
Well, first, Nick Hundley should make a difference to this team. When you watch what he did with some of the young staffs in San Diego, those guys are just coming into their own now, and I know Nick Hundley was a big leader with those guys, so that's what the Rockies are expecting. And with a guy like Jordan Lyles, who actually has been around, 4 years at a very young age, if a Nick Hundley can come in and help cut that learning curve, then you may have something. So that's what they're expecting out of Nick Hundley. Catching here in Denver with the high altitude, it takes a toll on a guy. So what do you do at the backup positions? Willian Rosario has been a catcher. He has struggled defensively. Last year he had some injuries but struggled offensively. They can't really find a trade for him, but if you've got a guy who's hitting 25, 26, 27, 28 home runs, maybe you don't need to give him away for a song. You find ways to get him behind the plate. You find ways to get him to first base. Michael McHenry is a very solid catcher, and last year he ended up hitting over 300 with some semi-regular playing time. So they do have three right now. I don't know if they will work out a deal before the season starts, but there is a possibility that they could carry three. Now, that would probably cost McHenry some playing time, but what that would do is free up manager Walt Weiss to use Willian Rosario as a pitch hitter, or, you know, even sometimes at first base in a matchup replacement for Justin Morneau, and still have power on the field in that type of game. So there are a lot of things the Rockies can do. There's nothing that they have to.
Okay, and let's. I think we should end this since the Hall of Fame announcement was just recently. So I think it'd be apropos to talk a little bit about Larry Walker only getting 11.8% of the vote. Does that surprise you? I hear a lot of people that give him a lot more support than that. But I think the crowded ballot is hurting a lot of these guys in their totals, even the ones that are a little bit far down. But what did you think about that?
Yeah, I believe the crowded ballot did push him down this season, and I'm not sure. I mean, at the end of his career, not a lot of people thought he was going to be a Hall of Famer, but they thought he'd get some votes, and he had the comment very early in the process that he would be just happy to stay on the ballot the entire time, and I think that's kind of where it's heading. Now, could some support pick up next year because they did get those four in this year? There's a possibility there. Certainly the sabermetric community likes Larry Walker a lot. I know from watching him, to me, he's a Hall of Fame talent. I mean, I like to compare him to a guy like a Dave Parker in that in the era in which he played, especially at his best, everybody refers to him as a future Hall of Famer because of what he's able to do. Now, does it last long enough to get into the Hall of Fame? Are the numbers quite what you want? In the case of Walker, did he play enough games in a season? I think that's always going to stick in voters' minds. But the fact that Larry Walker is able to hang on to the ballot, especially when the ballot is suddenly becoming more crowded, I think that's an accomplishment, but it would be nice to see him have a higher percentage.
Definitely. Okay, Thomas, thank you very much. We will be checking in with you soon. Appreciate it. I am here with my colleague, Steve Dilbert, who incidentally also works for MLB.com. Funny how that works out. Steve, so here we are. We are in early January, and Major League Baseball has officially sent out the dates that everybody will be reporting to spring training, so that gets everybody very excited. And so now the Diamondbacks just have to sort of figure out what they have going into spring training. And I don't know, reading some of your coverage, I'm thinking that the behind-the-plate situation is probably a pressing issue. So what do you see with the catcher situation and how that's going to shake out?
Yeah, Allison, you know, I really think that they still have to do something with the catching situation. Right now they just have Tuffy Goswich, who was their backup last year and you know, is an outstanding defensive catcher. I don't know if he's a guy that you want starting 140 games for you during the course of the year. They drafted a kid in the Rule 5 draft, but he played in the Midwest League last year. I'm not sure that he's going to be the answer back there either. And they want to give Peter O'Brien, who is a prospect they got in the Martin Prado deal from the Yankees last July, they want to give him some more time to develop behind the plate. So I really think that at some point here, they're going to have to find themselves a catcher. You know, Deonner Navarro seems like a guy that could make sense for the Blue Jays if they were able to work a trade with Toronto. But certainly it seems like that's the one glaring hole that they still have left to fill.
I mean, that is not just a glaring hole. I mean, I don't know. The amount of time I've been around baseball, like, I just feel like, you know, having like this, well, we're trying to figure out catcher, you know, on January 8th, 9th, 10th, whatever. I don't know. It kind of boggles the mind a little bit. I mean, I get what's been going on in the offseason and they dealt Montero. I mean, I understand everything that happened leading up to this, but, you know, getting a Rule 5 guy and thinking that, well, maybe that'll work, it just seems like, I mean, does this kind of take you a little bit off guard, a little bit?
A little bit, only because when we asked Dave Stewart during the winter meetings when the Miguel Montero rumors were kind of circulating, what his plans were at catching, he said, you know, obviously if we make this move, we feel like there's some other things that we can do. Now, I don't think he was referring to Oscar Hernandez, the Rule 5 pick from the Rays. So maybe he thought there was something else that was going to happen that hasn't happened yet, or maybe he knows that there's an offer out there that he can pull the trigger on when they finally decide to do so. But, yeah, it is a little surprising this late in the game to still be looking for a catcher. And, again, Oscar Hernandez, their thoughts are really high on him as a defensive catcher, but that's a really big jump to make from the Midwest League. And I just, you know, we'll have to see how that plays out. I mean, even in the Midwest League, you know, he hit .249, so he's still got some development there, and I'm just not sure they can count on.
Well, yeah, that's going to be probably the most interesting thing to keep our eye on with the Diamondbacks at this point. But let's talk about a little bit about the rotation. How many open spots are there heading to spring training? It looks pretty good at the top, and then there's a lot of guys on this depth chart, so there appears to be probably some competition going into spring training in that area.
Yeah, you know, that's one thing where they have talked a little bit about what the rotation looks like as of right now. And if you look at Josh Colemanter and the other people that Dave Stewart mentioned was Ruby De La Rosa, Jeremy Hellickson, and Alan Webster. De La Rosa and Webster were the two that they got from the Red Sox in the Wade Miley deal. Now, you know, then you start getting into Chase Anderson, Trevor Cahill, Vidal Nuno, Archie Bradley, Andrew Chafin, Robbie Ray. I mean, there's a whole, you know, a whole host of possible starters. I think that right now they have De La Rosa and Webster pencils into the rotation, but those two are not, I don't think, locks in terms of, I think they still have to show something this spring
in order to seal up rotation spots. I would say that Josh Coleminter and Jeremy Hellickson are probably locks to make the rotation, and then after that, it's kind of a free-for-all in terms of competition, with maybe De La Rosa and Webster having a leg up going into camp, but certainly it's not a set rotation by any means.
And actually, the thing that they didn't really mess around with a lot was the bullpen, and they seem to be pretty happy with that. Is that, the bullpen is always that thing that nobody really pays a whole lot of attention to, but if you have a bad one, it can absolutely crush your season. So, of course, if you have a bad anything, then it can crush your season. But really, what do you think? I mean, there's a lot long list of guys over there, too, but it seems to be a pretty solid group of guys.
It seems like that they feel pretty confident about the bullpen. You know, they've got Addison Reed as their closer. They had a young kid by the name of Evan Marshall kind of step up, a right-hander that he throws hard, that he kind of stepped up last year, and they were impressed with him. David Hernandez will be back at some point in the first few months from Tommy John surgery, and he was an excellent setup guy for them in the past. Brad Ziegler is another guy who's been consistent year in and year out, a very good setup guy, even closed for them when need be. And then you start to look at some of the prospects that they have coming up. I mean, they've got some hard throwers in Matt Stites, and they've got a kid by the name of Burgos down in the minor leagues that's very good, and Jake Barrett is knocking on the door, another hard thrower. So they've got a lot of depth there. So I think they feel pretty confident with the way the bullpen is right now, plus whoever doesn't make the rotation is also a candidate for the bullpen. So at least on paper, and again, you know, you mentioned that the bullpen can be wildly inconsistent from year to year. But certainly on paper right now, they feel pretty good about the depth that they have there in case some guys do falter.
I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about the Hall of Fame week that we've had. It was a very exciting time here in Houston with Craig Biggio getting in, and, of course, with Randy Johnson. It's a big day for the Diamondbacks, too. So, it's funny because Randy Johnson, I mean, he was in Houston for 2 months in 1998, and he was a much different guy on the mound and then off the field, you know, pretty relaxed off the field. And I think we're seeing a little bit about, he's animated, he's smiling a lot. He seems to have really enjoyed the last few days. What kind of impressions did you get from the whole experience with him?
You know, he was, as he said during his press conference, that he was wound kind of tight during his 22 years in the big league. I think anybody
a little bit.
That was around him. Could tell you and vouch for the fact that, yes, he was wound very tight. He felt like, you know, that he owed it to the fans, he owed it to his teammates to work as hard as he could. And in the way that he did that was he always was kind of had a chip on his shoulder a little bit that kind of kept his edge. But since his retirement, really, you know, I've talked with him off and on over the last few years. He's been like he was during his Hall of Fame press conferences, where you see him kind of laughing and joking and relaxed now that he no longer has to compete. He's an accomplished photographer. He's got his own website where he displays his photos, and he goes out and he's traveled the world taking photos. So he's found that passion, and he just seems to be very happy with where his life is at right now, and very relaxed, quite different than he was on the mound. And speaking of his time in Houston, Allison, he said that the 2 months that he spent in Houston, when he was 10-1 with like a 1.28 ERA, that not at any other time in his career did he have a better 2 month span than he did there in Houston.
Wow. You know, it's funny because I don't know if anybody, this is like a little known fact, but just with his height and the way that the ball, with his delivery, there was actually a billboard in the Astrodome in the outfield that was white, and the players could not pick up, the hitters could not pick up his pitches at all, to the point where they actually had to adjust the billboard because it was such an unfair disadvantage for the other team. So they had to actually make that adjustment. I don't know if anybody knows that, but
they do now.
Yeah, they do now. I figured, you know, 16 years later, 17 years later, it's probably okay to talk about it. But has there been any discussion on what did you say?
I said you're still dropping knowledge after all these years. That's very impressive.
Oh, yeah, I know. I have this, like, crazy memory when it comes to the late 90s. So has there been any discussion as to what cap he's going to wear? Is he going to go the Maddox way and just keep it blank, or what's he going to do?
Well, he was asked several times about that the day that the election happened, and he said that the decision is out of his hands, which is not completely true. The Hall has the final say on it. That part's true, but, you know, certainly the player has some input. But he was not going to give away what his input would be. There's a case certainly for the Mariners, but with the Diamondbacks winning four straight Cy Youngs, winning the World Series, winning MVP during the World Series, pitching a perfect game with the Diamondbacks, it seems like, all things considered, that he would go in as a Diamondback, but you just never know, and it's certainly possible. I could certainly see him go in as a Diamondback or go in, like the Greg Maddux, Tony La Russa route, where there's no logo on the cap.
I have a feeling that this is how it's going to go. Like, if he has a preference, then I think that he'll tell the Hall of Fame, and that they'll probably grant that, because it's so... You could, like you said, you can make a case for either, but if he just doesn't, I mean, he may feel very strongly about, like, not wanting, any logo on there. I don't know. It's kind of a political thing, because that would really be a bummer for Seattle if he went in, because he had so much success there, and for him to go in with a different cap, you're like, wow, it's kind of a gut punch, I would think.
Yeah, it's really interesting because he had more years. He had 10 years in Seattle, but he had 8 years in Arizona. And, the accomplishments he kind of came into his own in Seattle, but he had most of his accomplishments in Arizona. So maybe he'll surprise everybody going as an Astro for those 2 months that he spent in Houston.
I don't even think the Astros fans would want that. Like, when he came to Houston, I mean, it was the most frenzied, crazy, isolated time. Obviously when they won the pennant in 05, so that trumps everything. But it would be a Wednesday night against the Pirates, and there'd be 50,000 people in the dome because Randy Johnson was pitching. And it was so loud that the confetti that was in the roof that came down for the 97 division championship the year before, the Astrodome shook so much that leftover confetti started falling down on the field.
Allison, you need to write a book. I'm telling you, this is some good stuff that you're sharing that nobody has ever known before. So let's get together and write a book on this, would you?
Okay. Yeah, let's do that. So okay, we have to save some stuff for next week. So I think we'll cut it off now, and then next week we'll start talking about the often injured roster that seems to be on the mend, but we'll save that for next time. So, Steve,
all right, well,
thank you so much.
Hopefully you still have some good Astrodome memories that you can share next week, too.
This is the Diamondbacks podcast, so I'll try to keep it to a minimum.
Always good talking to you, Allison.
Thanks for listening to MLB.com Extras, the NL West.